In the 1840s, Americans began to develop an idea, Manifest Destiny, the idea that the whole continent should be theirs. But the conflict with Canada began much earlier than that, and that's what we're going to define first. Alan Taylor is author of American Revolutions.
Well, there was a border that was drawn by the treaty that ends the War of the American Revolution in 1783. But it's a pretty porous border. Neither the British government in Canada nor the American government south of the Great Lakes is in a position to regulate the flow of people back and forth.
The difficulty is, think of a border between Canada, as is now in the United States. No one knew where it was.
This is Kathy Burke. Her book is Old World, New World, The Story of Britain and America.
When the treaty between Great Britain and the United States was signed in 1783, they would say the border is going to go from the highlands in Nova Scotia down through the St. Croix River and through to 45th parallel, we will say. Now, what were the highlands? Which was the St. Croix River? There were three of them called that name. Which part of the Great Lakes belongs to each country? Are you going to fight over this? There were very rich fisheries, and there was the fur trade. And so most of the 19th century, the British in Canada and the United States fought along the border 12 times during the 19th century.
12 times?
12 times. There was the Lumberjack War between New Brunswick and Maine, also called the Pork and Beans War. Who gets this timber? There were all sorts of little wars. There was an unknown border. It matters on both sides to farmers, timber, the British who want a military road, the Americans who want to expand. And this mattered, you see.
This wrangling over the U.S.-Canadian border went on for almost 100 years. No one yet knew whose continent this was. The most serious conflict came in 1812 when, at the height of the Napoleonic Wars, America tried to grab Canada. This led not only to the burning of the British government buildings in what is now Toronto, but also the destruction by the British of the White House in Washington.
So during the War of 1812, this is not a war that the British wanted. It was declared by the United States on the British at a time when the British had their hands full waging war in Europe against Napoleon. So the British regarded the Americans as basically having dealt a sucker punch. American policymakers targeted invading Canada in this war in part because they thought it would be easy. British forces are stretched very thin. But one way by which they can make their smaller forces more effective is to use their great strength, which is the larger size of their navy.
What happened was that the Royal Navy was going down the coast towards Baltimore, which they saw as a nest of pirates, and came up the Potomac, firing a 21-gun salute as they passed George Washington's house, Mount Vernon.
Out of respect?
Out of respect. And landed soldiers. Now, the Americans, led by President James Madison by that time, thought that you didn't really have a standing army. This was dangerous. And the militia, as Americans, would come out and knock back the British. And, of course, the militia ran away. They were untrained. They didn't have the armaments that the British had.
The battle was just 6 miles outside Washington, which was where the British moved next. The president, James Madison, was just ahead of them. And when he reached the White House, the situation, according to one observer, was all confusion and flight. When the British arrived, they proceeded to burn and sack everything in sight, anything, in fact, that was connected with the government. And that included the Senate and the White House.
They fired the White House, which wasn't white before it was burned down, I might add. They fired the armaments and they fired the harbor. They also fired the Library of Congress, although the British said this was a bad thing to do. That should not have been done. And Dolly Madison, the wife of the president, rolled up the iconic portrait of George Washington and carried it away.
This war, sometimes dubbed the Second War of American Independence, changed very little territorially. But people living north of the border have good reason to remember it. I went to see Margaret Macmillan, esteemed Canadian historian and warden of St. Anthony's College in Oxford.
The War of 1812, for us, is an attempt by American forces to invade Upper Canada and Lower Canada, and they were repulsed by a combination of locals, British troops, and Canadian Indian troops, First Nations as we now call them, who have tended to be written out of the story, and I think they should be written back in, because they still were there in some force, they still had considerable political autonomy. But that was going to shift over the years as the number of British people increased, the number of Canadians increased.
And those Canadians, you said there were the First Nation forces, you said that there were the British forces, and then you said there were Canadian militias as well. Had those people started to identify themselves as something specific, or did they identify themselves in opposition to the emerging American state?
Two things were happening, I think. One is that they were very conscious they were not the Americans. And in fact, of course, a number of them were people who'd come very recently, who'd come from the United States, who were the loyalists. They'd come because they didn't want to remain part of the rebellious 13 colonies. And so the loyalist tradition in Canada has, from that point on, been very, very strong. But the second thing that was beginning to happen was that people were beginning to see themselves as, yes, British, but somehow a different sort of British. People don't immediately become Americans or Canadians. What they do is they begin to see themselves as people who have British heritage, but who are somehow different.
Did the American troops in the 1812 war loot Toronto?
Well, troops always did loot in those days, and I suspect they still do. The American troops came up to what was then called York. It later became Toronto. It was our new capital, very, very recently built. And they burnt it to the ground. They burnt our Parliament buildings to the ground, which is part of the reason why the British then went off and burned the White House.
So the White House was in response to the to the trashing of York.
Yes.
And of course, the British in this situation, for them, this was just a sort of sideshow of the Napoleonic Wars. Or did they have a more specific aim in mind in terms of Canada and America?
Well, there were always those in Britain, of course, who thought that the Napoleonic Wars might be a good time, if things worked out okay, to try and get the United States back. And also a sense that we'll just punish the Americans. And there was a certain amount of annoyance and anger that the United States had backed the French.
One of the surprising things about the War of 1812 is while Americans lost their initial goal in the war, which was to conquer Canada, they succeed in the later stages of the war at fending off British counterattacks. So while the British counterattack succeeded in capturing Washington, D.C., it failed when that same force moved on to try to capture Baltimore in nearby Maryland. And there was also another British invasion to attack Plattsburgh, New York, and that was defeated. And then the most important of the British invasion forces was to try to seize New Orleans in Louisiana. And that also failed in a most catastrophic fashion. And just as news of this battle reaches Washington, D.C., news comes across the Atlantic that peace negotiators have concluded the war. And so Americans set out and they start effusively celebrating this war as a great victory for them. And they tended to remember all of their victories and to forget all of their defeats except for one. And that was the burning of the public buildings in Washington.
The weather today, huge snowflakes are dropping on my jacket. It's a blizzard. It's been predicted for days. When snowstorms sweep across the US, they're easy to spot. And the weather on the Atlantic seaboard can be harsh, and in the north, very cold. But out to the west lies the promised land, over the Appalachian Mountains to the Rockies and beyond. It was land that drove the early settlers and the opportunity to carve up an entire continent for themselves.
I think the Canadian-US border is formed in two separate stages, and the first stage is the border in the east. Once you get beyond the Great Lakes, they come to an agreement that they will just draw a border between them, and they draw it along the 49th parallel, out as far as the Rocky Mountains. And so you have the borders really decided by someone drawing a line on the map saying this is a convenient line, an agreement that somehow the great continent had to be divided between the British Empire and the United States.
I'm at Penn Station in New York about to get a train, but I've just heard an announcement go across the concourse that anyone traveling north and crossing the Canadian border needs to go to a pre-check in place to have their documents validated. Now, ever since I've been coming to the United States since the 1970s, that border between Canada and America, you can just basically walk across it or drive across it. It's been one of the loosest borders I've ever come across, but now it seems things are getting tighter.
I think what's happened is the Americans have become more fearful. September the 11th, 2001, was something that shocked Americans to their core. And Homeland Security, this vast bureaucratic apparatus, this whole web of laws sprang up. And one of the things it's done is make the borders a lot tighter. But that means the old ease of travel between Canada and the United States has gone. That's ended.